Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You listen to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listen to Tangent's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and thanks for joining the program today. Last week, we came to the end of the 8th chapter of Shanti Davis' A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the chapter on meditation. The next chapter is on wisdom, or the nature of reality, but often commentators skip it because it's difficult to understand, even for those already with some knowledge. In fact, Shanti Davis was teaching to an audience of monks who would have had a grounding in what emptiness is. They would have taken teachings on it in their classes at the monastery. So for most of us who've had no such prior understanding, he will inevitably seem to be talking gobbledygook. Actually, much of the discussion in the 9th chapter concerns how the higher schools of Buddhist thought refute the lower schools. And unless you know what each believes, it's very hard to follow what Shanti Dev is explaining, especially as the nature of reality is very subtle. In any case, we're told not to explain emptiness to those who have little understanding or who have very fixed views about reality, for such an explanation will either cause them great distress or could lead them to believe that nothing exists at all, which is definitely not what the Buddha taught. His Holiness the Dalai Lama tells a story of meeting up with an Indian, a Hindu I think, who asked him about the Buddhist view of selflessness, the ultimate understanding. When His Holiness explained it to him, the Indian man began to shake with fright. He was so scared to think that he didn't exist as an inherent independent being that he could barely contain himself. Only after many discussions with His Holiness did he get some understanding and start to calm down. So I'm not going to continue into the 9th chapter of Shanti Deva's text. Not only have I not had extensive teachings on it, but I also do not understand the various schools' arguments well enough to talk about it. However, in this program, we will talk for a while on what emptiness means and try to gain a little understanding. But if you start shaking with fright, you can switch my voice off and go and have a nice cup of tea. I'm going to use the explanation given by Buddhist scholar and author Alan Watts in his book Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up. Because it doesn't go much into the intricate, subtle, and sometimes bewildering explanations by Buddhist scholars of the monastic traditions, but explains more from a point of view we Westerners can relate to. Watts claims that for many people in the West, Buddhist practice really starts with cultivating an understanding of emptiness. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his teachings, stresses that this may be the best way for many of us to gain confidence in the whole range of Buddhist teachings, because it does not need a leap of faith. We can gain an understanding of emptiness through our intelligence alone, and as we begin to understand, faith will arise. So if you don't know about emptiness, as we talk about it, you may not be frightened at all, but perhaps intrigued. However, before we go any further, let's set a motivation as we usually do for the program. As usual, try to make the motivation bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, for that is the most far-reaching and beneficial motivation we can have. Thank you. And now on to emptiness. Those of you who know something about it, please excuse me while I wax basic in the beginning for those who don't know what emptiness is. Perhaps you can use what follows as a kind of catch-up to your understanding. What do we mean by emptiness? Well, if I told you I had an empty cup, you would know that I was holding a cup with nothing in it. This might imply that when a Buddhist talks about the emptiness of a phenomenon, it means that that phenomenon has nothing in it. That is, it really contains nothing, so doesn't really exist. This is not what we mean by emptiness. When we talk about a cup being empty, we have to understand that it is empty of something. In other words, it does not contain tea, water, milk, or marbles. Whatever you think of, that thing is not in the cup, unless it's air. Similarly, when we talk about the emptiness of a phenomenon in Buddhism, we're saying that it is lacking something. In this case, an independent, inherent existence. The phenomenon does not have such an existence. It does not exist as an independent, inherently existing thing. But that does not mean it does not exist at all. In fact, emptiness indicates the mode of existence, not whether there is or is not existence. It is about how things exist, not whether they exist. Take a table, for instance. When we enter a room and see something capable of holding things up, we label it table, because we already have a generic concept of table in our mind. We think that what we see is really a table from its own side, as though it exists as a table, whether we are observing it as such or not. But when a cat comes into the room, does it see it as a table? Perhaps it sees the high, flat surface as something to jump up and sleep on. When a fly buzzes into the room, how does it see the table? And does every human in the room see the table in exactly the same way? Obviously not. We all see the table according to our various visual faculties and conceptions. Then, when we look at the table, where is it actually? Is it the top? Any of the legs? All of the legs? The bits connecting the legs to the top? Is it all these things together? Would it still be a table if I put one leg sticking out the side, another sticking upwards, and a third running along the bottom of the flat surface? No. The table only exists as a collection of causes, conditions, and parts that come together in a certain way and serve a certain function, according to the mind that labels table. No independent, real table existing inherently from its own side can be found anywhere in the collection of various parts. We say that the table, therefore, is empty of such an independent, inherent existence, even though, when we do not analyze, our minds automatically grasp the table as having that kind of independent existence. Let's take another example, this time by Alan Watts, who uses a person reading his book as an illustration. All readers would agree that the pages of the book are white, but what, he asks, is the whiteness? Is it something out there that is white of itself, independent of our vision? No, he says, the whiteness depends on our perception. The essential thing to realize, he writes, is that an act of sight is a result of complex interactions between the object being seen and the sensory faculties. Vision is an emergent event, not some little window through which images and colors stream into a passive receptor. If you were a bee, for instance, would the page appear to you in the same way as it does to you as a human? If you were a bat, an owl, or a snake? No. Each creature has its own unique way of seeing the page that is quite different from the way other creatures see it. Even among the readers of this book, writes Watts, there will be subtle differences in how we see a page. Our eyes may vary, some with astigmatisms that distort the vision, others with conditions that variously alter the image. We may light the book in various ways, or hold it at different angles. For each of us, a unique flux of visual imagery constantly changes within our field of vision. The visual field, roughly an oval space that contains the book and whatever other objects are around it, is in front of each of us at this instant. What each reader sees while reading the book is unique and dependent upon that person's unique faculties. And here's the main point. He writes, our visual perception does not exist in our absence. If there's no visual faculty, the perception and the perceived visual object do not exist at all. In other words, the perception and the perceived visual object only exist in dependence on our faculties and the interplay between those faculties and what we see as the object. They do not have an independent and inherent existence. Then, if you and the bee, the bat, the owl, and the snake, and all the other humans see the page of a book differently, is there something out there we know as a page that exists independent of all our perceptions and concepts, as if it had its own characteristics that had nothing to do with our perceptions? Alan Watts takes a star as another example. On a clear night, we go out and look up into the heavens and see a tiny white light. But the star as we perceive it is dependent upon the visual faculties with which we are seeing it, Alan Watts writes. The perceived star would not exist without someone to see it. Is the star that we perceive out there many light ways away, or is it somewhere else? The idea that it is out there is obviously absurd, for it would imply that our eyes were able to condition something hundreds of light years away. In other words, our eyes would be able to reach out over hundreds of light years and grab the characteristics of the star. Watts continues, to make it more absurd, the star is not there where we see it anyway. The star has moved since its light started journeying across space hundreds of years ago, and the place where we see the star may be nothing but empty space. Then he asks, if the perceived object is not out there, where is it? It cannot be in our bodies, because no matter how hard we look, we will not find it there. Although seeing entails a complex series of neurophysiological events, that does not mean the seen object is somewhere in our heads. All sensory experiences are dependently related events involving both external physical events and our own sense faculties' interaction with them, writes Watts. But we don't act as though they have something to do with us. We believe that sensory experiences are just what they seem to be. As Watts says, we hear sounds and think, what a noisy place, never considering what role we as listeners play. This process is called reification, in which we imagine something to have a substantiality or tangibility that in fact it does not have. Through reification, we ignore the subjective contributions to an event, seeing it entirely as an objective entity, he writes. From the Madhyamaka point of view, the viewpoint of the school of Buddhist thought Shantideva subscribed to, reification is faulty, because the way things appear to us are not how they actually exist. And that is why this school says that the world we perceive is dreamlike or illusion-like. What is actually there then, we may ask? And we come to that old conundrum, what happens if a tree in the forest falls and nobody's in the forest to see or hear it? Most people agree something happened, writes Watts. The tree trunk is on the ground, there's a big dent, things start to rot, and ants and termites live in the fallen trunk. But what happened? To answer the question, he takes a short trip into the way Western scientists have gone about looking at it. Since Galileo, science tried to avoid misleading subjective experiences based on the senses by relying on mathematics and mechanical instruments to make objective measurements. By the end of the 19th century, the objective science of physics, according to at least the scientific world, was just about complete. Watts writes, the physics of the time was assumed, with very few exceptions, to be an absolute representation of what was really out there. And then came quantum physics, and suddenly it became very obvious that the characteristics of speed, mass, shape, and place depended very much not on their objective reality, but on the way that they were measured. Watts quotes the great physicist Werner Heisenberg, who said, what we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. Now, if you have any interest in quantum physics, you will know about the experiments that show the dual nature of light particles or photons, which can either appear as particles or as waves, depending on how you're measuring. Albert Einstein got the Nobel Prize not for his work on relativity, but for work on the photoelectric effect, which accounts for why closing lift doors slide open again when you put your hand in the doorway. When light is shone onto metal, it releases energy, and a small current may flow through the metal. However, the color of the light matters. Even bright red light will not produce a current, but dim blue light will. This is inconsistent with the idea that light is a wave, because the brighter the light, the more energy it gives out. So a bright red light should produce a stronger current than a dim blue one. Postulating that light, instead of waves, comes in tiny packets called photons, Einstein showed that the small photons of red light didn't have enough energy to affect the metal enough for a current, whereas the larger photons of blue and other colors did. However, another experiment shows that light must be a wave. Basically, a light source, like an electric bulb, is placed in front of a barrier with two slits in it, so that the light passes through the slits and falls onto a screen behind the barrier. What you get is a pattern of alternating bands of light and dark. This is because the light moves as waves and spreads out with crests and troughs through the slits. When a crest of one wave meets a trough of another, they cancel each other out. But when two crests meet, the light is intensified. And when two troughs meet, dark is intensified. This results in the pattern of light and dark, called an interference pattern, as it is caused by light waves interfering with each other. Think, if you like, of water moving through two gaps in a seawall, and the waves that result against the land behind the wall. Even the experiment of single photons fired at a barrier time and time again will result in an interference pattern, indicating that photons have a wave-like way of communicating with each other. Now, if light is a stream of tiny particles, as Einstein showed, when you send it at the two slits, you would get the same pattern as you would if you fired a machine gun at the slits, some bullets going through the slits and hitting the screen, and some hitting the barrier. You would not get an interference pattern. But you do, even if you use single protons in the experiment. Nevertheless, scientists have fired single photons at each other and other elementary particles like you can fire bullets at each other. And because you can do this, we've built the Large Hadron Collider. It turns out all elementary particles have the same nature. They can either be particles or waves, depending on how you are measuring them. Another nail in the coffin of the idea of a complete objective science of physics came in the form of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which shows that at the quantum level, the more you know about one characteristic of a particle, the less you can know about another. For instance, the more accurately you measure the velocity of an electron, the more uncertain you become about its position. And the more you know about its position, the more hazy your knowledge of its velocity must necessarily be. In his book, Einstein's Moon, physicist F. David Peet writes, "In fact, when you think about it, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle makes perfect sense. A measurement of, say, the position or velocity of an electron involves interaction with an experimental measuring apparatus, and any interaction implies some interchange of energy. After all, if no energy is interchanged, then nothing would have changed in the measuring apparatus." Planck and Einstein had pointed out that this interaction must involve at least one quantum of energy. Since there can never be a fraction of a quantum, the minimum uncertainty in a measurement must be the size of one quantum. In other words, the way you are measuring makes a difference to the result that you get. Ultimately, what this uncertainty led to was the realization that the quantum world was ruled by probability waves, not by fixed realities. As David Peets writes again, philosophers have always been concerned with questions like, how can we know anything for certain? And what is the difference between knowing something and believing it? Since our senses are fallible, for instance, our sight can be deceived by an optical illusion, how can we be sure about the things we touch, hear, smell, and taste? The great philosophers of history have faced these questions and attempted to answer them. But now the task has fallen to physicists. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle was forcing the Copenhagen group to ask what it means to have knowledge and certainty about the atom. Indeed, they were beginning to ask whether atomic reality actually exists. Classical physics offers complete certainty and predictability. Quantum theory suggests a reality in which no absolute knowledge is possible and in which indeterminism replaces determinism. And going back to Alan Watts, we find the subjective element seems to be inescapable on all fronts. In no facet of science, whether we are dealing with astronomy, physics, or medicine, do we get even one bit of information about any reality existing independently of our modes of questioning. All of our sensory experience consists of appearances that are contingent on our sense faculties. Even by reducing everything to the subatomic level of electrons, quarks, and so forth, we are still left with nothing but appearances. What is inescapable is that all we know of the world, theoretically and empirically, consists of appearances to the mind. We have access to nothing else. And yet, he says, we ignore what we bring to a thing or situation, our subjective perceptions and conceptions, and see everything as if it had a concrete, independent existence. This is our great mistake. But even if we do take on the idea that everything we experience is dependent on the mind, can we then say that the mind itself is independently and inherently real? Watts claims that, just as with everything else, we tend to give the mind an independent, reified existence. To cut through this reification, let us consider a moment of awareness within the continuum of consciousness, he writes. That moment's past has vanished and its future has not yet come. But when we try to conceptually isolate the moment's present, we see the same continuum of time again. The moment we thought was in the present also has a beginning and an end. As we continue this process, searching for the present between the beginning and the end, the present instant of awareness becomes infinitely immediate. Any mental event becomes unfindable. The mind turns out to be ultimately unfindable. It is not in the past, it is not in the future, and it is not truly existent in the present. If we subject it to this form of ultimate analysis, it just vanishes. Did you get that? When we look closely at the mind, we cannot find it in the past or the future, for the past is gone and the future is yet to come. However, when we try to isolate the present moment of mind, we can only find a continuum. We can never point to the present moment, for even as we start to point to it, it is gone, lost between beginning and end. Watts continues, we also discover the mind has no location. We can find no compelling reasons for locating the mind in our heads or anywhere else. Awareness itself has no shape, no color, no size, and no location in time and space. He takes as an example the perception of a blue shirt. We might think the blue, the shirt, the mind, and so on are all independent events with their own independent existence. However, how can we have a mental perception of the blue shirt without the shirt, without light, without our eyes, with their pupils, corneas, retinas, and so on, without our consciousness? As the perceived blueness of the shirt is a dependently related event, dependent on one's visual faculties, so too is one's visual perception and mental awareness of the blue dependent on that color, writes Alan Watts. And he goes on, so even the mind turns out to be no more substantial, no more intrinsic than any physical phenomena. It is dependent on factors around it in time and space, as are physical phenomena, and likewise has no inherent nature. This very absence of an inherent identity or self is what is known as emptiness. All phenomena are empty in that they lack an intrinsic nature that exists in and of itself. Physical phenomena, the mind, the self, all of them are empty. All are dependently related events. It is our ignorance of this and our grasping at everything as having an independent existence that leads to our suffering. When we lose sight that everything arises depending on other things and nothing has an existence purely from its own side, we concretize ourselves and everything else. Everything we experience seems to have a real, inherent and independent self-nature, and myself seems separate from everything else. Then I develop attachment to what I see as beneficial to me and mine, and aversion or aggression towards everything that I perceive as against me and mine. This root ignorance gives rise to confusion, to attachment, to hostility, and to all the other mental afflictions, such as jealousy, conceit, arrogance, and selfishness, writes Watts. The antidote, then, is to experience the emptiness of all phenomena, and to recognize their nature as dependently related events. This recognition of emptiness and dependent arising, of course, is where all the Buddha's teachings lead. I'd now like to turn to one of my favorite Buddhist masters, Thich Nhat Hanh, once again, who always presents emptiness from the viewpoint of dependent arising. In his book, The Heart of Understanding, an explanation of the Heart Sutra, the briefest form of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, he talks about interbeing. I love his story of his conversation with a leaf. It goes like this. One autumn day, I was in a park absorbed in the contemplation of a very small but beautiful leaf in the shape of a heart. Its color was almost red, and it was barely hanging on the branch, nearly ready to fall down. I spent a long time with it, and I asked the leaf a lot of questions. I found out the leaf had been a mother to the tree. Usually, we think that the tree is the mother, and the leaves are just children. But as I looked at the leaf, I saw that the leaf is also a mother to the tree. The sap that the roots take up is only water and minerals, not good enough to nourish the tree. So the tree distributes that sap to the leaves. The leaves take the responsibility of transforming that rough sap into refined sap, and with the help of sun and gas, send it back in order to nourish the tree. And since the leaf is linked to the tree by a stem, the communication between them is easy to see. I asked the leaf if it was scared because it was autumn and the other leaves were falling. The leaf told me, no. During the whole spring and summer, I was very alive. I worked hard and helped nourish the tree, and much of me is in the tree. Please do not say that I am just this form, because this leaf form is only a tiny part of me. I am the whole tree. I know that I am already inside the tree, and when I go back into the soil, I will continue to nourish the tree. That's why I do not worry. As I leave this branch and float to the ground, I will wave to the tree and tell her, I will see you again very soon. Suddenly I saw a kind of wisdom, very much like the wisdom contained in the Heart Sutra. You have to see life. You shouldn't say life of the leaf, but life in the leaf and life in the tree. My life is just life, with a capital L, and you can see it in me and in the tree. That day there was a wind blowing, and after a while I saw the leaf leave the branch and float down to the soil, dancing joyfully, because as it floated, it saw itself already there in the tree. I was so happy, I bowed my head, and I know that we have a lot to learn from the leaf, because it was not afraid. It knows that nothing can be born and nothing can die. And with that, we must bid each other goodbye. I hope you've gained some benefit from the program today. Thank you for joining us, and as you go, please dedicate any positive potential to the enlightenment of all beings. The blessings of all the Buddhas be with you. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.